Okay, well, thanks. Before giving you the bottom line, I should give you some idea of what it's about. You're all familiar with the fact that if you have a very large scattering length, then there is necessarily a very loosely bound or shallow diatomic molecule, and its binding energy goes to zero, like 1 over a squared, as a increases. If there's a large positive scattering length. If you have a large positive or negative scattering length, in the three-body sector, there is a sequence of three-body bound states, and these bound states are called Efimov states. If you let the scattering length increase to infinity, they don't get shallower and shallower. They approach finite limits. But as you increase the scattering length, what happens is that more and more Efimov states appear in the spectrum. And as the scattering length increases, the number of Efimov states increases logarithmically with a number. And at infinite scattering length, there's infinitely many Efimov states with an accumulation point at zero energy. And moreover, they have the strange property that if I look at their binding energies, the ratio of successive binding energies approaches a universal number, which in the case of identical bosons is about 1 over 500. So these are the Efimov states. And what I want to convince you of is that they have possibly important applications in cold atom physics.
What do you say? Presumably applies to bosons and to distinguishable particles, not necessarily to fermions, does it?
If you have If you have a three-body system where two of the three pairs have large scattering lengths, you have a good chance of getting the Efimov effect. But the universal number will differ from that. May differ from that number 515.
So I have two parallel and one antiparallel spin.
Yes. And if there are equal mass, there will be no Efimov effect. If the mass ratio exceeds a critical value, there will be an Efimov effect. Okay.
Will you be telling us the simple physics why these are happening?
I will try. Okay, I have to tell you the punchlines, but to appreciate the punchlines, I have to give you two examples of atoms with large scattering length. So the first example is the helium atom, which has a scattering length that's about 100 angstroms, which is large compared to the size of the atom and also large compared to the scale set by the van der Waals potential. The other example is an alkali atom at a Feshbach resonance. Now there's something quite different about these two cases, and it may not be the difference that you first expect. For helium atoms, they are bound states in some potential that looks kind of like that. The reason there's a large scattering length is that there is a very shallow bound state in this potential whose depth is about 1.3 millikelvin. So there's a large positive scattering length. In the case of Feshbach resonances, what you have is a scattering length that depends upon the magnetic field, and it can be roughly approximated by some background scattering length plus some term that diverges at a resonant value. So the scattering length can be adjusted with the magnetic field, and it can be as large as you like. One difference is that this, in the case of the Feshbach resonance, it's really a two-channel problem. You have a channel for the atoms under consideration for those particular hyperfine states, but there is some other channel that is closed to the scattering states, but there's a bound state in this channel that's being tuned very close to threshold, and it's a resonance with that bound state that gives you this resonant behavior in the scattering length. Now the important difference for my purpose is not one channel versus two channel, but the fact that this helium atom has no other bound state besides that two-body bound state. Whereas in this case, of the typical alkali atom, there are dozens of two-body bound states. And furthermore, this molecule here has deeper states. And that will make a difference. So now let me get to the punchline. The punchline is that if you're in the lead region of very large scattering length, there are, along with FMOV states, comes very dramatic variations in rates for various few-body processes. The simplest ones are rates at zero energy, and those are called rate constants. And these rate constants scale, if you have a large enough scattering length, they will scale as with the dimensions required by dimensional analysis. So for example, one example is the atom-dimer scattering length should scale with the scattering length A. And as you increase A, it will increase. The rate constant for three-body recombination, if you work out the dimensions, should scale like 8 to the fourth. So it varies very dramatically. Some rate constant for relaxation of dimers into other molecules will scale like A. But the coefficients of these are not just constants. I mean, first of all, these rate constants are not constants because they stay very dramatically as the scattering length varies. But moreover, the coefficient of the scattering length, sorry, the coefficient of the scattering length is not a constant. So the simplest example is this atom-dimer scattering length. And try to ignore the dashed lines, which are the effective range. But the scattering length has a form that has scaling behavior, but the coefficient is a periodic function of the logarithm of A. And that coefficient diverges at particular values of A that differ by multiples of 22.7 in this case. It's not too hard to figure out what's going on here. What's going on is that at these values, there is an FMOV state appearing in the spectrum right at the atom-dimer threshold. And it's the FMOV, the FMOV state going through the threshold that corresponds to the atom-dimer scattering length going through infinity. So just below, when A is large and positive, there's a very shallow FMOV state that's essentially an atom-dimer bound state.
So this Petrov pattern is 1.2A for this value. I mean, does that correspond to some asymptotic?
1.2A. This 1.2A is probably a fermion, a bound state of two fermions. I mean,
it's a dimer atom.
It's an atom dimer scattering.
Okay. Yes. The atom. Right. Threshold. Yeah. I should mention that the FMOV effect occurs with fermions, but not for equal mass fermions. And for most of the talk, I will be talking only about bosons because that's the simplest case where the FMOV effect occurs.
Is it the equal mass that's important or the distinguishable effect?
They all affect what that universal number is.
But I'm puzzled by your statement that the FMOV effect occurs for fermions if they have unequal mass, but not if they have equal mass. Is that simply because if they have equal mass, you're assuming they're identical about the molecular basis?
If they have, well, if they're fermions, if it's two spin states of fermions, then only two of the three pairs can have resonant interaction. So that's one big difference, where there's three resonant interactions or just two resonant interactions. And then on top of that, these universal numbers depend upon mass ratios. And in the case of the equal mass fermions, there is no FMOV effect.
Even if they are not identical?
I'm sorry, no, if I'm sorry.
If
three distinct spin states of fermions with equal masses and with all of the three pair interactions with having a large scattering length will have this same magic number 515 as the okay. So this is one example. Another, yes.
There's only one bound state in that helium.
There's only one helium dimer.
I should calm down.
Yes, there are no other deeper states.
Is it the same for metastable helium?
Jorah would know. I don't know.
Metastable helium certainly has a scattering length which is comparable to that of the alkali. So again, that was under X-strons.
Mm-hmm.
I would sort of tend to assume it had that of Olsen direction which is comparable.
Mm-hmm.
So you should have more interaction long range is not 1/r6 because the metastable stable state have quaternions. So
for my purposes, this excited helium will be like this case because it has this, that excited helium can decay into this excited helium dimer. I mean, this is a lower state that will make metal. There will be the helium dimer is unstable and it can find deeper states to decay into.
Yeah, it takes a really long time to do it.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so that's one simple example. The next simple example is the three-body recombination rate, which, if you look at the rate equation, which defines the rate constant, it'll tell you that this alpha should scale like 8^4 just by dimensional analysis. But again, the coefficient is not only is the alpha not constant because it scales like 8^4, but the coefficient is not constant. It's a periodic function of the logarithm of A. And it has this bizarre behavior of oscillating between 0 and 61.7, and with a period that the oscillation period is a factor of 22.7 in A. And the most marvelous thing is these zeros in the recombination rate. So there are values of the scattering length at which, in spite of the scaling of like 8^4, the recombination rate will be zero. So if you could take the helium potential, I should mention this case and the one I just showed you apply to helium where there are no deep bound states. They both get modified if I have deep two-body bound states. But if you could adjust the helium potential to drive this closer and closer to the threshold, you'll find that at special values of A, the recombination rate goes to zero.
It will change
it in this way. There's a new parameter that entered the game that I am calling eta*, and depending on the value of that parameter, you will either see the oscillations or they will get damped out. On top of that, you have a new channel. When you have deep two-body bound states, you have recombination not only into the shallow dimer, three atoms come together, two form a shallow molecule and one flies apart, but also two of them can form a deep molecule and a recoiling atom. And if you take very strong inelasticity, what you'll find is that these two rate constants are identical, 16.8, and equal to 1/4 of the maximum value here that you would get if there was if there were no deep two-body channels. So that's another marvelous feature that requires an explanation.
So is there any experimental work on these two, or is it all theory so far?
There has been no experimental observation of any FMOV physics. There's been no convincing experimental observation of any FMOV physics whatsoever. And
do you think it's likely that with the so-called payload molecules that you can make using Feshbach resonances, you'll be able to do that?
I hope so. That's certainly a dream.
So, the three-body bound state corresponds to maxima and
the FMOV state appears at the threshold right near the maximum here, okay, but not quite. Yes.
Just a simple question. Are there some experimental difficulties to observe?
Well, there's
subtle points.
Here's a very severe difficulty, 8^4. If you want to see this periodicity, you need to increase the scattering length by a factor of 20, 22.7. 8^4 increases by 10^4. So your loss is increased by 4 orders of magnitude when you try to map out one period. So that's
losses.
That's losses are the most serious, well, they certainly are a very serious problem. I'm sorry, yes?
Just again, so this physics has been explored. Do you mean nobody ever seen trimers?
In the case of helium, there are actually two helium trimers. Okay. One of them, only the deepest one has been observed. It you can make the case that it is an FMOV state, but someone who doesn't care about FMOV physics could say it's a coincidence that
about whether it has been verified experimentally, Petrov has a recent paper, and he also gave a talk. Unfortunately, I don't remember the detail, but I only remember that he claims under for many alkalis that the width resonance is of a certain size with the Eisenbahn regime, and as a result, it agrees quite well with some of this prediction.
I'll mention that paper at the end of the talk.
What's his
experiment? Basically.
Yeah. What he has seen, I mean, what agrees is rates in the region of approaching the large scattering length region. And so what he's verifying is that the resonance model with no background effective range, if you stay away from the large scattering length, it agrees with those recombination predictions.
That's a 90 of FMOV states, is what you're saying.
The measurements are getting close to the FMOV region, but they're not there yet.
And what, can you give me a physical understanding of the Skeeter star? Maybe you said it.
Yes. But you'll have to wait a while. Okay. This is recombination for positive scattering length. For negative scattering length, there's no dimer, so you can't have recombination of the shallow dimer, but you can have recombination into these deep molecules. Notice that the coefficients here range from 0 to 60. If I go to negative scattering length, the coefficients, well, rates. It's the same parameter A to star. This A star is also related to the parameter before. So it's the same, as I go to negative scattering length, the same constants enter in, but you see that there is this very dramatic variation of the rate constant the coefficient of A to the fourth in the rate constant. It has this resonant behavior. What's happening at these points is that there is an FMOV state at the three-body threshold. You have negative scattering length, and the FMOV state can appear at the three-body scattering threshold and give you this resonant enhancement of the rate constant.
These formulas look very sort of generic. Do they actually assume, for example, the standard van der Waals potential?
No, they're just large. They only assume just a contact interaction, so it's assuming a zero range potential.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So for the van der Waals interaction, you have to have this tune the scattering length to be large compared to the scale set by the van der Waals force, which is...
Wouldn't you expect that to make a big difference in the case of deep, we can imagine deep molecules, because after we're showing the structures, the deep molecules must be important.
No, it's not. That's the one of the marvelous things is that the structure of the short distance structure is not important. These results will follow from the conservation of probability, and the short distance structure, however complicated it will be, will preserve probability.
In any case, what distinguishes between shallow and deep state? I mean,
shallow is close to threshold. Deep is.
I thought you need some kind of potential to be able to
talk about them. Well, shallow means binding energy that's on the scale set by A.
Yeah.
And deep means much larger than that.
When I tune this
other molecule to zero, I get this large resonant scattering length. but I have all these other states in this potential that are not changed much, not affected much. And those are all the deeply bound states. They have binding energies that are of order the van der Waals scale or deeper. And I have one shallow bound state that's...
So you're saying explicitly in the theory there's another bound state?
Or many.
Okay. But it has to be put in there.
It doesn't... Whether it's, I mean...
I mean, what I'm confused by is, right, you're talking about scattering rate A, but the A can't distinguish between, how can you distinguish between shallow and deep states? Just like one parameter.
Right, the A doesn't tell you that.
Okay.
Well, but...
What is telling you the fact that you have a deep state?
The fact that the fact that there's any recombination at all for negative scattering length tells you there must be a deep state to recombine into.
But A is not referred to all the deep state. A is referred to the state called.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then that state has a chance to decay into something
lower. The two-body doesn't. It's the three-body bound states.
So there are some deeper states, and then now they have this shallow state of three-body version.
But he's talking about the dimer shallow and the deep. So what is the dimer deep? I mean, where does that come from?
It comes from all, in the alkali atom, it's all these 127 deeply bound.
You have to put other states into the problem.
Well, the problem has other states.
Okay.
And I'm telling you what effect they have on the physics at energies set by the scattering length. And they have a very simple, they have effect that's captured by the scattering length and by some, by two additional parameters. One is a parameter that determines the FMO spectrum. Another is the one that determines the width of these resonances.
No, and the property of these deep states are all absorbed in this eta star.
Yes. Yes. Okay. And as you tune the scattering length, to be larger and larger, any other details of the deep states will become more and more irrelevant. Okay, so that's the punchline, and so what I want to do now is turn to the two-body problem and describe some of that. Oh, maybe before I should go on, I should mention why you might care about this. Well, one reason you might care is that if you can find minima in the three-body recombination rates, then if you tune your system, if you have a Bose-Einstein condensate and you tune it to that value of the scattering length, you might be able to suppress the losses that are such a severe problem when you have a very large scattering length.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Like you suppress, for example, three-body recombination, but what about four-body recombination? Because I guess you do not have any small parameter. Or you suppose that your scattering length is still much less than the inter-party
The only thing that will suppress four-body is the density, the density effect.
You still have a gas parameter, a small gas parameter.
Well, I would like to make it as large as...
We need to take into account 4, 5, and 6.
Yes, at some point you need to take into account those as well. Unfortunately, the four-body problem remains, for the most part, unsolved, except for a few exceptions.
From solution, we have just an estimate, so we need some reasonable argument why we can forget about a higher order process, just because of the low enough density.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, and one way to get away with forgetting higher processes is to make NA cubes small enough that they get suppressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would like to have NA cube not small, and yet the two-body recombination rate is small. Well, one is hoping that the four-body rate, because higher power and density, and maybe also some of the scaling property that would give you a lower rate, but you do want to operate at the point where the scattering length is very large. Right?
I want to see FMOV physics,
okay, yeah.
And so I have to get to large enough scattering length to see it, and hope that losses don't kill me on the way.
So.
Yes.
You're talking about FMOV states coming in one by one, right? So before you get to the infinite set of FMOV states, when you just have one or two or three of them,
what have you put in the numbers to figure out what NA cube should be in order to get these one or two or three FMO states? I mean, that's where you, I guess, get the...
Well, N has to be 3 to get an FMO state.
Okay.
So N equal 3 is the minimum. But, I mean, if you ask...
Sorry, NA cube is a unit
no.
density.
No, I need the number of atoms to be 3 to get the FMO effect.
I understand it.
And if I want to see FMO effects in the properties of Bose-Einstein condensate,
yeah.
That's a question that has to be studied carefully and
along. Numbers for that.
Well, the numbers depend on parameters that are the short answer is no, I don't have them on top of my head.
Are there bound states in full body and light body channel in a statement about?
If you have a large scattering length, there are also necessarily four body bound states whose energy is determined by the contact interaction only. And, yes?
What they call only met in the case of three particles. In the case of four particles, there are none.
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
No, the question
no,
is bound states, but not F, but what the concept of F mod has been generalized to. I thought the question, Faye's question was whether there are bound states, but he wasn't asking whether there's a sequence. In many bound states could come in the ratio with a universal number, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's just asking the existence of bound states.
If I have a large scattering length, there are these sequence of three body bound states. There are also four body bound states whose depth is set by the scattering length.
Is there a sequence of four bound?
Their properties are not well understood. There has been much study of that.
Are there just minimally bound states?
I'm sorry?
People are saying that in the case of four particles, weakly bound state can appear only accidentally. That's what that's. And this physics that you want to expound for three particles, it's not present in the case of four particles. That's what nuclear physicists say.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's very unique to three particles.
Yeah, that's what they say.
I don't know to what extent this is true or not.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know whether this is true or not.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just telling you what they say.
All right.
Is there some simple explanation for this? Right? Because in 2D we have weakly bound state and three. For two particles we do have weakly bound state. For three particles they exist there, you know, state. And what happens when we just add one more particle?
In two dimensions? Were you saying in two dimensions?
No. I'm just trying to find some argument.
Mm-hmm.
Why 3 is a magic number as compared to 4?
Well, you can have an image. Imagine please that your scattering length is large and positive.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? Then we know that in a many body system, you have nice repulsive interaction between particles and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yeah.
The collective bound many body state is absent in this case.
But it's just the statement, it's not the explanation.
Gentlemen, Eric's punchline has become a punch page. And then I think we should move on and then see what the physics is.
Okay, so I'm going to start with a two-body problem and just tell you things that are trivial, but it's useful to be reminded of them. So what I want is a large scattering length, so it's large compared to whatever the relevant range of interactions is, which in case of atoms is often set by the van der Waals length. But so there's some length scale that I'll just call L, that A should be large compared to. And what I'm interested in is energies that are small and set by the same length scale. I'm sorry, energies that are small compared to that same length scale. And I want to ask, what are the few body observables? And there's only, the two body problem is very simple. There's can be two things, bound states and scattering. And in the case when A is negative, there's no shallow two-body bound states with energy small compared to this short distance scale. If A is positive, as you well know, that there's one. And I call it the shallow dimer. Its binding energy is given by this very simple formula. Scales like 1 over A squared. Okay. And the other observables are cross-sections. I'll call this dimer labeled capital D sometimes, so I'll call it atoms A. So I'm interested in atom-atom scattering, and as a function of the energy, as long as the energy is small compared to this scale. And in this case, the information is a little bit more, is a little bit richer. There's a non-trivial energy-dependent formula for the cross-section. It, as a function of the wave number, it looks like that. And it has the value 4a squared at k equals 0. There's a region in here where it's scale invariant. It scales like 1 over k squared. And then at very large wave numbers, the problem will get complicated because the short distance scale will come into play and P waves will enter and everything else. Okay. But I want you to notice a couple things. First, that there's scaling behavior. The binding energy scales like 1 over A squared. This differential cross-section scales like A squared if you have very small energies, and it scales like 1 over k squared if you have large energies compared to the scale of scattering length. Because of the scaling behavior, it's useful to plot the possible states on a graph whose horizontal axis will be 1 over a. Let me draw that. So a equals infinity is the vertical axis here. And I'm going to define a wave number variable that to give it the same dimensions as a. It's basically the square root of the energy. And on this is the plot of the energy versus the inverse scattering length. And on this scale, the atom threshold is here at 0 at k equals 0. This two-body bound state, this dimer, is here as a 45-degree line. And so if I look at a vertical line corresponding to a specific scattering length, I see that there's one, at this value, one bound state, and then a continuum of atom-atom scattering states. Okay, the reason I want to introduce those variables is that I want to show you what the three-body spectrum looks like. So this is the two-body. So again, I'll have 1 over A as my horizontal axis. And of course, if you're near a Feshbach resonance, 1 over A is just linear in the magnetic field. This time, the three-atom scattering states will have a threshold on that line, because up here there can be three atom scattering states. Here there can be atom dimer scattering states. So any bound states have to be below this line. And if you start increasing the scattering length, moving this way, what you'll find is that at some critical value, an FMOV state appears, and its energy behaves as a function of scattering length. It approaches a smooth limit as A goes to infinity, and then disappears at some critical value of positive A. If you increase the scattering length by another factor of 23, another FMOV state will appear and will disappear. Then another one, and another one, another one. And at infinite scattering length, you'll have infinitely many FMOV states with an accumulation point at zero energy.
What sets the scale for that point? Must be some other length.
Yes, here we had a continuous scaling symmetry. It's if I take lengths and scale by some factor, and A and scale by the same factor, then I will map a point on this, a point with a given scattering length onto another point with a given scattering length that's related by the symmetry. If I take A equal to infinity, then I have A gets mapped to itself, and I have a continuous scaling symmetry. In this case, it's clear I don't have a continuous scaling symmetry. However, what you do have is a discrete scaling symmetry. If I take my coordinates and scale them by integer multiples of some value and scale the scattering length by the same integer multiples, then it'll map. What you'll do is map by one FMOV state onto a different branch of the FMOV state, but everything will be invariant. So there's.
You still have to have an absolute length scale.
Yes. So there is some. One of these FMOV states, when you go to tune into infinite energy, will define a length scale. For example, the binding energy of this particular FMOV state, I could I could define a wave number scale from that binding energy, and it's this wave number scale that comes into that formula I wrote for the asymptotic FMOV spectrum. The binding energy asymptotically, I didn't write it down, but let me write it down now. The binding energy will asymptotically approach
Yeah, what sets the scaling
case
off?
Yes, that's
short.
Yes. Yeah. So I'll explain in a minute how that actually arises. This number, by the way, this number here first of all, its value is approximately 22.7. But it comes out of the solution to a transcendental equation whose origin I will show you in a minute. But I'll write it down just so you can know when it's coming your way. If you solve for this transcendental equation, you'll find that the solution is 1.00624. And so it's very close to 1, so in any formula I write with that zero, you can just think 1. You'll be good to 1%. But anyway, if you take e to the pi over f0, you'll get this discrete scaling factor that if I square it, I get 515.
In that formula you've written for b3n, is n star automatically 1?
Well, I've chosen to define kappa star to be the binding wave number of the n star FMOV state.
So the natural convention would be choose it.
Well, there's really, I mean, in this limit when A is infinitely large, there's deeper states and so on. So if I take A large, if I make A large compared to, well.
A large corresponds to going up, could not go down.
Yeah. This is really the definition of kappa star, that as you approach the at infinite scattering length, when you approach the accumulation point, there's a parameter that comes in that defines a length scale. Of course, that parameter is only defined modulo multiples of the square of this number by this formula. But still, it defines a length scale that is not present in the two-body problem. Okay, now let me go back to the purpose of analogy, let me go back to the two-body problem and explain how you might approach that. Suppose I have two particles. One of the important variables is the separation of these two particles, separation vector R12. And in the center of mass frame, if you work in the center of mass frame, then the only relevant variables are first a radial variable, that's the length of the separation. So this is the radial, so we just call it the radius. And the angles, the direction of that unit vector. And a convenient way to organize a problem is to first separate it into an eigenvalue equation for the radial variables, whose solutions are the good old spherical harmonics. Eigenvalue problem for the angular variables. And what you get out of that is an effective potential for the radial variable. The effective of R. And it'll be your original potential plus a term that depends upon the orbital angular momentum quantum number. And then you can solve the problem for the radial variable. And you can do something similar in the three-body problem if you use a clever choice of coordinates. Okay, so this time I have three particles. And here is three, one, two, and three. I can define in the center of momentum, center of mass frame, I can use two vectors to define the configuration. One is the separation of one pair, and the other is the separation of the third from the center of mass of the first two. Then a convenient set of variables is a hyperradius, which is just the RMS separation of the three atoms. It's just R12 squared, R23 squared, plus R31 squared over 3 to the 1/2 power, just the RMS average separation. It's convenient to introduce a hyperangle, alpha 3, will be given by some formula that's just, the important thing is that it involves the ratio of these two lengths of those two vectors. And there's a standard root 3 over 2. And then ordinary angles, R12 hat and R312 hat. And you can take these as generalized angles and solve the hyperangular problem, reduce it to, solve an eigenvalue problem for the hyperangular coordinates. In this case, it's not quite as simple. It'll give you eigenvalues that depend upon the hyperradius. They won't be constants like this case, where L was 0, 1, 2. But once you have this, then you can solve the effective potential. You can reduce the problem to an effective potential for R. This effective potential, the effective R, will be some complicated function of R that involves this hyperangle.
What's the
little R? Involves that eigenvalue.
Now, when you said effective potential for little R, what is the
effective
R?
Yeah, so effective potential for the hyperradius, yes. If I take zero angular momentum, then the formula for these hyperangles, it's not as simple as L equals 0, 1, 2, but it's relatively simple. It's that lambda to the 1 half times the cosine of lambda 1 half pi over 2 minus 8 over root 3 sine lambda 1 half pi over 6 equals r over a sine lambda 1 half pi over 2. So if you solve this equation for lambda, you can stick it into a potential and get a channel potential for each of the solutions of lambda. You'll find a channel potential. Okay. In this case, the channel potentials for various r's, had these for various orbital angular momentum look like that. In this case, what we get just from L equals zero alone, we get a sequence of effective of channel potentials. And let me just draw them for A positive, just to avoid, just to take one case. But you'll find the lowest one looks like this. It asymptotes to a value that's asymptotes to a negative value that's the binding energy of the dimer. The others asymptote to zero. And so what these correspond to, you can interpret these as three atom scattering states, whereas this you can interpret as the channel potential for atom dimer scattering states. Along with these potentials, there's coupling potentials that make these states. If you start on one channel, you can jump to others. But if you go to very large r or very small r, they decouple. And so at large r and small r, it's just pure. Once you're on a given channel, you just stay there. And then you can, when you get to moderate r of order a, you can jump between channels. But then you will, at small r, get to the channels.
How do you jump between channels?
Well, there's... Along with, you should think of these as adiabatic potentials.
Okay, yeah.
So in the spirit of Born-Oppenheimer, there are also coupling potentials that jump you between them. At very large r or very small r, the coupling potentials vanish, and you just have adiabatic evolution along a channel potential.
So the initial contact interaction becomes
I started with just a pure contact interaction. I've made the range of the interaction very small in comparison.
So still contacting this capital R?
No, it's the two-body interaction that's a contact interaction. There's a two-body contact interaction, nothing else. But when you solve the three-body problem, it's convenient to organize it in terms of these channel potentials, these effective potentials.
Okay. Yeah, but the two-body contact interaction, delta R12, how would it become in this hyper radius?
Well, the two-body interaction is really that the scattering amplitude as a function of momentum is this non-trivial momentum-dependent form. So it's the behavior, it's the standard behavior for particles with large scattering length. There's a momentum-dependent interaction that comes from unitarity, but this is the interaction. And it can be generated by simply having a contact interaction between two particles and then quantum corrections iterate to form the momentum dependence by unitarity.
My question is, what does that effect on this, what is that two-body interaction on this VM?
These are the three-body channel potentials given a two-body interaction of this form, which is precisely the two-body interaction you get from a contact interaction or from zero range potential.
Okay, let me try. So you write down a three body Schrodinger equation and then try to extract an equation for this so-called hyper spherical coordinates. So your wave function would be represented by hyper spherical coordinates bunch of all the other angles. But then you have a bunch of potentials. But then I think your question is what happened to the body potential?
Yeah, I assume your potential is just the summation of all the three pairs. Yes. In the three body equation, your potential energy is a summation of 1, 2, 2, 3, 1, 3. These three pairs. And how?
Yes. Yeah, so each pair has a zero interacts through a zero range potential with a non-zero scattering length.
How does those terms show up here at the hyper radius equal to zero, or no?
Well, the hyper radius is, remember, the RMS separation of these three particles. So if you integrate out all the other variables, you're left with the RMS separation of these three particles, and in that variable, this potential as a function of hyperradius will have these forms.
It's hard to see how you go back to the original.
It requires some derivation. How does one get to that from three body Schrodinger equation with a pseudo potential into a hyperspherical coordinate in with a wave function with a Schrodinger equation of this? In this coordinate and then with this superpotential, I think that requires some derivation because Eric would may not want
to. Yeah, it's a little bit, I mean, it's analogous to what you do in the two-body problem, but it's more complicated because the hyperangular eigenvalues are not constants, they're functions of R.
Okay, so I'd really like to know how, I mean, this is like standard FMOD stuff, so I want to know how you put in all the deep bound states.
Yes, that
problem.
That will come.
I want to make sure that you get to that. So
yes.
I know that everybody wants to ask questions, but that's the really new part.
For the two-body problem, there's this angular momentum, which is just L, right?
Yes.
So, but then now there are so many angles. How many quantum numbers do I need? Only one L, or are there any other quantum numbers that you have set to zero?
Well, for each L, you get one channel. Here, you're going to have many channels. The lowest channels will all be L equals zero. So what I've drawn is the lowest L equals zero channels. On top of that, there's higher. Okay. Now, one simplifying feature is that all these hyperangles become very simple at large R, and there's only one negative. This minus 4 was chosen here because if you have there's a critical value of the 1 over R squared potential where it's ill-defined at short distances, and with the hyper angle I've chosen, this critical value is minus 4. Actually, I think there's a 2 here. Yeah, let's make this. H bar squared over 2mr squared. Okay, but anyway, these land ends approach constants at short distances. And so in this region, the potential, this behaves simply as it's just a 1 over r potential with a coefficient, well, this S0 that I, whose value is almost 1, comes from solving this equation at r equals 0 and finding that the lowest eigenvalue approaches minus S0 squared. Anyway, at the short distance, at the short distances, this is a 1 over r squared potential. In that potential, you can easily solve for the hyperradial wave function. This is the lowest hyperspherical potential, n equals 0. And the hyperradial wave function will have some power of r, but this will be the solution of the hyperradial wave function. What it has, what the this is a incoming hyperspherical wave, and that's, sorry, this is an outgoing hyperspherical wave, that's an incoming hyperspherical wave. Okay, now, these are big R's, I'm sorry. These are hyperradius. Okay, A and B are undetermined constants. That's just a general solution to the second order differential equation. But if I have if there's no deep two-body bound states, then you can constrain, just conservation probability constrains these coefficients. So A, the magnitude of A must equal the magnitude of B, and now you're down to one undetermined constant. And what will determine that last undetermined constant is the, well, it'll be the short distance physics that I have swept to, well, I've taken the limit where I don't see it. But that short distance physics one way to capture it is to simply choose a specific radius and the logarithmic derivative of the radial wave function at that radius. Those two numbers will are enough to specify the influence of short distance physics on this problem, because there's only one pathway which through which particles can reach short distances, and so all you need is the logarithmic derivative of that lowest hyperspherical wave function to specify the short distances. And that'll tell you this hyperradial wave function reduces to r to the 1/2 times the sine of S0 log of R times some constant. And the constant depends on this short distance. So with a suitable choice of numerical constant, I can take that to be that parameter defined by the Efimov spectrum, the fact that the binding energies asymptotically approach the dimensionful constant that enters into the Efimov formula can be, this is where it comes in, through the boundary condition at short distances. Okay, so now I just have to explain what happens when you have deep two-body bound states. And it's Well, the complication is that there are additional three-body states that you can reach through a low-energy three-body state. And that is, you can have you can have scattering states of atom plus the deep molecule. These will have low total energy. But large kinetic energy. They'll consist of a atom recoiling in one direction and this very compact diatomic molecule recoiling with opposite momentum in the other direction. And those will have an effect, but fortunately their effect will be the fact that you have only one way to get to short distances means that the effect of those deep two-body states can only take its influence through this channel here. What it'll do is guarantee that you no longer have this total reflection of probability from short distances that you have otherwise. What you have is instead that there'll be some fraction of the probability will be reflected, some fraction less than one.
And that's kind of Fishback resonance term. I mean, the kind of artificial one where you kind of a couple of particles are kind of removed from the system and kind of convert into
it. Well, this is representing the fact that the Fishback molecule can relax into deep. It takes into account the fact that the Fishback molecule is usually an excited state. Not the ground state in that channel, but it has states it can relax into. This will take into account the fact that it can relax into deep.
Add an extra term for that kind of effective term where you have a transform between a Fishback molecule and a small molecule or something. I mean, it looks like you could represent something which only goes through a single channel as a kind of.
Well.
That same kind of Fishback tumbling through get through a little channel and hop into it.
But then would one would be, if one wanted to do it within their hyperspherical wave functions, then what would have
something like a Fishback within the hyperspherical.
If you have a Fishback molecule, and you add a let's say psi dimer. If I have a Hamiltonian with a term like that with the molecular field, and if I add an imaginary part to the coefficient of that, this imaginary part reflects the fact that this molecule can decay, and maybe it's minus I gamma, but anyway, if you allow the molecule decay, its influence on the atoms at short distances will come entirely through this probability parameter when you make the scattering length large enough.
I guess on this subject, that what you've written down, if zero of r, doesn't look to me like a bounded state wave function.
What does not?
If zero of r.
This.
Yeah. Looks to me like a scattering state wave.
Well, it's a it's the superposition of waves in here.
Is it half or the one half? I don't remember. Is it R to the first exponent?
Well, this
minus or half or
it all depends on your normalization condition for.
It's Laplace
relation. If you. If this is the normalization convention I have is r to the fifth because it's really the radius of a six coordinate system and that affects what are the appropriate factors of r and things like that. And it'll fall off exponentially once I get to the region. See, if there's a bound state here, when I'm inside the throat here, it'll be waves up coming and going, but then it'll look like, and then it'll fall off exponentially once I get there. So this is inside, this will apply to the FMOV bound state at distances small compared to the scale set by the energy of that bound state. Anyway, the bottom line is that if you take the scatter length to be very large, then all these low energy observables will be determined by three parameters. The scattering length, this some parameter that sets the scale of FMOV states when the scattering length is infinite, and also this probability parameter that the last two of these parameters arise from the boundary conditions at short distances that you've removed from the problem. So let me just at the end tell you about, well, how would you apply all this? And yes.
So I'm just notational questions.
Yes.
You're defining your parameters. In your transparencies, you have this A star floating around. How does that relate to these three?
Well, that was, it's differs by a multiplicative constant. I had the A star to make the formula simple. But that was, that was the value at which, this was the critical value at which an FMOV state appeared. So this was my A star. And its value compared to this thing is something like, 13 times, 1 over A star is something like 13 kappa star or something, which is, yeah.
So
anyway, yes, they're all different by known multiplicative constants. Okay. Oops. So how would you determine these parameters? If we have deep molecules, we have. Three body system. A three body system with large enough scattering length. Requires three parameters. How do you determine them? Well, one way is just by phenomenology. For example, one way is possibly to measure three-body recombination rates with large scattering lengths, and therefore deduce. Well, you need two measurements to determine two three-body parameters, but by measuring three-body recombination rates, you could do that. Another possibility is if you believe you have a very accurate two-body scattering model, then you can simply calculate these parameters. And that's what was done recently by Petrov. Most of you have seen the resonance model. I have some idea what it is. But the short summary is that the 2-to-2 scattering amplitude has a form that looks like this. And I guess if I want this to be a scattering length of zero momentum, I should need 8 pi in the top here. And if I go to k equals 0, this gives me pi, let's see, lambda minus g squared over nu minus ik. And then I can read off this as the scattering length. Okay. So it's a model that allows me to tune the scattering, get a large scattering length by tuning some kind of parameter nu, tuning the detuning of this of this molecule. What Petrov did is take the special case where lambda equals zero, so there's only the resonant term, so the scattering amplitude reduces to minus nu over. So this is exactly what you would have if you had a model with a scattering length and an effective range and nothing else, but it's a negative effective range. This is an effective range that's minus 2 over g squared. And so it's a model with a scattering length, negative effective range, and nothing else in the scattering. And in this model, he computed what these parameters were, the parameters that describe the three-body physics. This model has no deep two-body bound state, so he gets eta star equals zero. And it cannot really be zero because those deep two-body bound states will, I mean, he's talking about alkali atoms with many deep two-body bound states. They will come in at some level, and it's not clear what suppression factors will make them small, if any. But anyway, within this model, what he found is that, well, he called this he called this parameter R star here. I might have screwed up some. Yeah, there's 8 pi over here. Well, yeah, okay. Sorry, this is a k squared. Anyway, he called this negative, the minus 2. This the negative, the absolute value of the negative effective range he called R star. But what he found is that the first F mod state occurs when you increase R star, when you increase the scattering length to 0.5445 times R star, and the first zero of the recombination constant occurs at the scattering length that's 3.3 R star. And two of the suggested applications, he suggests this should be accurate whenever this R star is large compared to the natural scale for scattering lengths, which is tens of angstroms for alkali atoms at least. But anyway, two of the possible applications are, let's get rid of this. Sodium 23 at 907 Gauss, there's the Feshbach resonance, and rubidium 87 at 1007 Gauss, there's also a Feshbach resonance. The values of R star that you get just by fitting, where did my scattering length go? My scattering length was something like lambda minus g squared over nu. So this is the detuning of the molecule. This is the off-resonance, proportional off-resonance scattering length. This is the coupling to the resonance. Anyway, you can figure out, I mean, from these terms in the scattering length, you can figure out that R star, in this case, is 260 angstroms, which sounds reasonably large. In this case, it's 320 angstroms. And you can ask, when is the first FMOV state? And that requires, for the sodium, you have to retune the scattering length to 117 117 angstroms, which isn't way out of sight. The zero in the recombination constant, for Sipmoff state. For this one, it's also 144 angstroms, which is, again, not absurdly large. You can easily reach those in experiments. And finally, the zero in the recombination constant, here it occurs at 858 angstroms, which is getting up there, but still reachable. And this at 1,050 angstroms. So this is the first step in really making F of MOF is quantitative in cold atom physics. If you have what you believe is an accurate model of the two-body scattering, you can deduce what these three-body parameters are, and then go ahead and predict where you'll see some of this marvelous dramatic interference effects and resonant effects.
Okay. But from some of your earlier comments, are you saying that you have some questions about the accuracy of this number? Because, since he's forgetting about the background scattering name, and then for example, in your mm-hmm. formula for ALK, the last expression is pretty general, but then if the explicit expression of R star, its estimate would be affected if you use a resonance model, whether your resonance model includes or excludes the background scattering means. And also that would depend on how close you are to the criterion you use to say how close you are to the FMOF regime. So can you comment on, suppose your background scattering name, at what point that we are close to the FMOF regime?
I don't know the answer to that yet. And I, he showed results on, okay, in this three-body recombination rate the A over alpha to the fourth, alpha over A to the fourth, the constant, the coefficient of A to the fourth in the recombination constant, as a function of the logarithm of the scattering length. This is something that varies periodically. And what he showed is that there's data that fits pretty well with the behavior short of the FMOF region. So that suggests that the model might be an accurate enough representation of the physics of this Feshbach resonance. Unfortunately, you haven't yet gotten down to where you can see the experiments have not gotten down to see the zero yet, but at least it tells them where they can aim for.
So are there attempts or so at looking at the tremors directly?
Well, it would be very nice to produce the Bose-Einstein condensate of trimers, and that then that would be very convincing evidence for the existence of FMOF states.
Yeah.
No, I don't know of any attempts to really do that. It would help. I mean, it would help if we could tell them exactly what to look for, and pinning down these three-body parameters is an essential first step, because if you just say, well, if you increase the scattering length by another factor of 20, there's certainly be an FMOF state, and their loss rates increased by 10 to the 4, they might not be willing to waste their time on that. But if you can tell them, well, you just have to get another factor of 3 and you can see the FMOF state, then they might be willing to.
Surely a post-condensate of trimers would be unstable with respect to a post-condensate of dimers.
Sorry.
Why? No. The timers are lower in energy, so.
If you have more than 3, that's because of the phase of 4, for example. Rather than having one trimer and one isolated atom, you'd rather have 2 dimers. Mm-hmm.
Well, the trimers are lower in energy.
Here's,
what's that?
Low in energy than a single dimer.
No, there's lower energy than a single dimer and an isolated atom.
Yeah. but they're not more than two times.
So primer, you mean primer collisions?
Yes.
Two possibilities. One is that three of them form a trimer and the other has zero energy, essentially.
Yes. Okay? Yes.
So then I get the epilogue energy.
Right.
Okay? The other is just to have two times.
Yes.
I have twice the dimer energy. So surely that's better.
Well, it depends on where you are. Okay, so what you need to know is this is the dimer, and this is twice the dimer. And so these FMOS states go like that. So there's places where they would be stable under that process. Of course, yeah. After all, when you go to zero infinite scattering length, there's no dimer. I mean, the dimers are zero energy. So here at A equals infinity, the dimer is here and your trimers have smooth limits.
But if you're on that side and you're talking about bosons, that's then it's scattering length, right?
Yes.
It collects. It gets many body collects.
Yes. Unless you tune to this scattering length, which means there'll be a very large three-body. If there's at this value of the scattering length, there'll be a large three-body contact interaction that could stabilize this BEC with a negative scattering length.
Okay, well, probably we have to do many body physics.
Yes.
Okay. So two questions and a comment. I'll start with the comment. And that's
yes.
If you put in the numbers for Na cubed, I mean, you know, you're well below Na cubed equal to 1. So I don't. Since you have a 4 and 5 body and all of that, I mean, just the numbers just now. Na cubed or 10 to the minus 2 with 10 to the minus 5th, depending on which of these numbers features.
Uh-huh.
So I think you're fine.
Oh, good.
Okay. And then so that's the comment. So the questions are, first of all, what happens when you put in the exact bonding energy that Conan presented? So you have a bonding energy that's always goes to 1 over a squared, right? So that's sufficiently close to the resonance, but
yes.
You know, further away can be different. I just wonder how that changed your results. And the second thing I was wondering about many body effects, there's this thing about this, for example, even if you have a quasi-bound pair that they can't decay in the presence of a Fermi C, for example. Okay, this is only for fermions.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I invalidate that part of the question.
Okay.
Okay, so myself. So let's just go to the bonding energy question.
Mm-hmm. So can you repeat the question?
So for Karin's, if you put in Karin's expression for the bonding energy, which covers a range even away from the resonance, how does this change your results? Have you tried that? You have bonding energy as 1 over a squared.
No, the...
maybe I misunderstood. I saw this written on the board several times.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, somehow related to... Maybe this will help with
mm-hmm.
It's related to Jason's comment that if you put R star... You are using R star much larger than the background scattering length.
Yes.
Yeah. So the more general binding energy that Lincoln is referring to doesn't have that assumption built in. So
yes.
When you put that assumption in, then, for example, the experimental data for the binding energy start to diverge. The predictions from this assumption don't agree with experimental data on binding energy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to have the non-zero back
yes.
getting in.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Is it difficult to do?
I think Hedgehog could have done it. I think since you have the expression and then the...
It's not...
This estimates are for...
I guess the question, what is the correction? The correction must be lambda divided by A, and lambda is the background scattering length, A is the actual scattering
mm-hmm.
length. So to the extent, that correction is small, then I think this estimate would be reasonably accurate. So there would be corrections, but they're all
very close to
the position of zero should shift.
Very,
that's the thing.
Very close to resonance, yes. Once you move away.
What will suppress it? That's what's not quite clear to me.
Just to not run too long. Now, we have reached an hour and a half, so I think we should close it at that. So
that's fine.
We can have lunch or
late lunch.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yes.